Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Mathur jagdhana panadhyayar Eda dhatur asammate Shetevin murtayor garte Sajantur jantu sambhave Mathur jagdhana panadhyayar Eda dhatur asammate Shetevin murtayor garte Sajantur jantu sambhave Matuhu of the mother. Jagdha, taken. Anapana, by the food and drink. Adhyai, and so on. Edhat, increasing. Dhatuhu, the ingredients of his body. Asammate, abominable. Shete remains. Vit murtayoho of stools and urine. Garte in a hollow. Saha that. Jantoho fetus. Janto of worms. Sambhave the breeding place. Translation, deriving its nutrition from the food and drink taken by the mother, the fetus grows and remains in the abdominal residence. Excuse me, abominable. Yes, both. Abominable residence of stools and urine, which is the breeding place of all kinds of worms. Yuck. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. In the Markandeya Purana, it is said that in the intestine of the mother, the umbilical cord, which is known as apayani, joins the mother to the abdomen of the child, and through this passage, the child within the womb accepts the mother's assimilated foodstuff. In this way, the child is fed by the mother's intestine within the womb and grows from day to day. The statement of the Markandeya Purana about the child's situation within the womb is exactly corroborated by modern medical science, and thus the authority of the Puranas cannot be disproved, as is sometimes attempted by the Mayavadi philosophers. Since the child depends completely on the assimilated food of the mother, during pregnancy there are restrictions on the food taken by the mother. Too much salt, chili, onion, and similar food is forbidden for the pregnant mother because the child's body is too delicate and new for him to tolerate such pungent food. Restrictions and precautions to be taken by the pregnant mother, as enunciated in the Smriti scriptures of Vedic literature, are very useful. We can understand from the Vedic literature how much care is taken to beget a nice child in society. The Garbhadana ceremony before sexual intercourse was compulsory for persons in the higher grades of society, and It is very scientific. Other processes recommended in the Vedic literature during pregnancy are also very important. To take care of the child is the primary duty of the parents, because if such care is taken, society will be filled with good population to maintain the peace and prosperity of the society, country, and human race. Verse again, Matur Jagdhana Panadhyaya Edha Dhatur Asammate Shetivin Murtayor Garte Cha Jantur Jantusambhave. And the translation, deriving its nutrition from the food and drink taken by the mother, the fetus grows and remains in that abominable residence of stools and urine, which is the breeding place for all kinds of worms. Om Ajnana Timirandasya Gananjana Salakaya Chakshuran Militam Dina Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha. Sri Chaitanya Mano Bhistam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Svayam Rupa Gadamayam Dadatisva Padantikam. On many occasions, Prabhupada described that one of the primary duties of the spiritual master is to explain in very clear and explicit terms that trying to enjoy in the material world is a fool's paradise, to detach the living entity from the God project of trying to be the Lord of material energy. Essential part of spiritual master's function, Prabhupada is showing us once again his expertise. And of course it's derived from the authority of the scripture. Not just haranguing on his own accord, but simply presenting very, very clear understanding. The worldly picture of someone, husband and wife, begetting a child, and how wonderful, and congratulations, and what about the living entity that's in that situation? Poor. So the expectation of happiness is given another picture here. It's not. It's a necessary arrangement, but the necessary arrangement also has its lessons, and the Bhagavatam wants us to understand what those lessons are. That's one feature of. Prabhupada would refer to this section of the Bhagavatam from time to time, indicating what an unfortunate circumstance the living entity is in. Within this very wonderful position of being the child of a pregnant mother. Very, very difficult for the living entity. And another thing that this section of the Bhagavatam is doing is giving further clarity to the position of Krishna as the controller of the whole cosmic situation, down to the micro as well as the very large scale situation. The first verse of the Chaturshloki from the Bhagavad Gita indicates this very important Vedic conception, that is, everything that exists comes from the Supreme. Aham sarvasya prabhavo matak sarvam pavartate Iti matva bhajante ma buddha bhava samandita. It's the first verse. It's so much of the subject matter of the Vedas is sambandhagyan, understanding the relationship of all things with their source of emanation, God. What is that relationship? So the principle is, who is God? God is He from whom everything else comes. The absolute truth is that from which everything else emanates. And then the Bhagavatam here is expanding on that principle down to the position of the living entity within the womb. Prabhupada has described the correlation between Bhagavad Gita and Bhagavatam and Chaitanya Charitamrita. So I want to lay that out a little bit here. Bhagavad Gita is ABCs. It's just stating fundamental principles that we were discussing last night with Bhrigupati. It's, you can take, just like a ball of cotton, you can take the ball of cotton, dip it in some ghee, and twist it and make a ghee wick. And then you can use that in Krishna's service. Or you can take the cotton ball and strand by strand pull it apart and look, oh, here's this strand and here's this strand. And a lot of the exposition of the Vedas is like that. You can put it in very terse and concise terms and move forward and serve Krishna with the knowledge of the Vedas. Or for persons who have propensity to look in detail at things, you can take the strands out. The message of Bhagavad Gita expands in Srimad Bhagavatam. The relationship is Bhagavatam is the graduate study of the ABCs. And Chaitanya Charitamrita is the postgraduate study of the Bhagavatam. So, in Bhagavad Gita, as in all of the Vedas, Krishna is the source of everything, and one who understands that, what do you do with that understanding? Iti madva bhajante mam. A person who has a little integrity, once they understand where everything comes from, there's something you do with that. You serve. The Supreme Great, we're very tiny, we're part and parcel of that Supreme Great. When in the fourth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, to amplify that statement, Krishna describes in 434 the famous verse where if you want to know the absolute truth, you approach a spiritual master, and with submission, inquiry, and service, that's the qualification one needs in order to get knowledge. We know that verse. Tadviti pranipatena pariprasnena sevaya. The next verse is where Krishna describes this message of what is that knowledge? What's the fruit? What's a symptom of someone who has that knowledge? They understand that all living beings are part of Krishna and that they're in Krishna and they belong to Krishna. And then Prabhupada introduces this part and parcel phrase that he was so fond of using. Here in the Bhagavatam, that understanding is being amplified. The living entity is within the womb of the mother. But the mother is supplying the ingredients to that living entity, and she is getting the ingredients from something outside of her. That's what she eats. And where does that come from, what she eats? It's part of material nature. Where does that come from? And just follow the thread. And that material nature is from Krishna. And Krishna is the controller of that material nature. And then in the micro form, the living entity that takes shelter in the, as the previous verses have described, within the semen of the male, and that enters into the womb of the mother, and then conception takes place, and then the womb of the mother supplies the ingredients. This is a micro description of what happens within creation. Within creation, where do those living entities come from? And where does material nature come from? They come from Krishna. So Mahavishnu glances over Pradhan. We learn this from the Bhagavatam. And the details of that are discussed in Chaitanya Charitamrita. This material nature, it's the, before Mahavishnu glances, it's called Pradhan. That's the undifferentiated sum total of material ingredients. It's like a big warehouse that doesn't even, things are so jumbled up, it's not even differentiated what's what. And by Mahavishnu's glancing, living entities enter, the time energy enters, and everything differentiates into the 24 elements. So the ingredients are all set up. And with the time energy and the spiritual energy of the Lord, it appears that material nature is then producing creation. So the Chaitanya Charitamrita discusses this. I'm going to read a little passage from Chaitanya Charitamrita where Krishnadas Kaviraj, in the postgraduate study, discusses this. There's two features of Maya. I'll read the verses but explain it first. The two features of Maya are Pradhan Maya and Nimitta Maya. Pradhan Maya is the ingredient. Nimitta Maya and Upadhan Maya. Upadhan and Pradhan, in the purport, Prabhupada uses them interchangeably. The Upadhan Maya supplies ingredients, just like we're reading here in the Bhagavatam. The womb of the mother supplies ingredients through the umbilical cord to the child, the fetus. So there's the technology, there's the mechanism for doing that, but the principle that's behind it is ingredients are being supplied, and that's a feature of Maya. That's the Upadhan Maya. And the other is the Nimitta Maya. Nimitta Maya is the womb of the mother supplies the chamber. So the mother does both of these things. She supplies the chamber in which the living entity grows. That's the womb of the mother. And she's supplying the ingredients, which nourishes the body of the child. So these two features, the causal principles of existence, are there within the womb of the mother. So ingredient cause and material cause are the way Prabhupada has translated these two terms. But then there's a third cause, that's the remote cause. And the remote cause is the cause of those two other causes. So we can describe, just like Sri Brahma Samhita describes, that Durga is the cause of creation, maintenance, and destruction of the universe, which is true. But where does she get the ability to do that? She gets that ability from her consort, Lord Shiva. And where does that ability come from? From Krishna. Therefore, Govindam Adi Purusham Tamaham Bhajami. So this is, it's a detailed analysis. I'll read a little bit and you'll see it goes into more detail. But that's the taking the strand of cotton and pulling the strands apart, and that's what a cotton ball is made up of. That the creation of this material world works on these principles. And then you put all the principles together, and one who is situated in knowledge, what do you do with that knowledge? You serve Krishna. Because he's the cause of all causes. And he's put this thing together in such an amazing way. A completely fantastic way that has its analysis. You can take it apart and put it back together. I mean, not that we can create material energy, but we can see how it's cause and effect. That's basically what material knowledge or technology is understanding the cause and the push and the pull. You wiggle something over here and something over there moves. You understand the cause and effect of material nature. And that's what a lot of what technology is. You go to a university and you study how cause and effect things work. And then you can produce gizmos and gadgets and put it in the marketplace and make a living. But where's the credit? Where's the science that teaches those principles of cause and effect, where do they come from? Who's the controller behind it? Who's the one who energizes the whole thing? Who's the one that makes it happen and makes it not happen if it doesn't happen? How does the process of reproduction work? The Bhagavatam is giving, but we should understand behind this description is the causal principle, the personality of Godhead, who is manipulating the nimitta and upadan maya factors. Even the husband or the father and the mother don't have a clue how it's happening. They just go along with the yantra rudhani maya. They're just going along with the conveyor belt and it's happening. So a very big part of spiritual knowledge, the knowledge of Bhagavad Gita, the knowledge of Bhagavatam, knowledge of Chaitanya Charitamrita, is to put behind all of our activities, put credit where credit is due, put consciousness of the personality of Godhead right in the focal point. And for those who have an inclination, for those who just like accepting the principle Haribol, it's there. The principle, the authority of Bhagavad Gita states, Aham Sarvasya Prabhavo. We can't do anything without the sanction of Krishna. And then there's the graduate and there's the postgraduate study of those principles. Some persons like to understand, well, how does the push and pull work? And the fruit of knowledge is to surrender to Krishna. Oh, this is how the push and pull works. And one of the things that Prabhupada is doing very clearly here in the purport is he's stating the Markandeya Purana gives this information thousands of years ago in detail and without the advantage of modern technology of analyzing the push and the pull. How does it work? How did they know? Because of descending knowledge. It's a different system. Prabhupada liked very much to... How many times have we heard in Prabhupada's lectures Prabhupada explaining how many species of living entities there are? It was like, when I hear that, Prabhupada quoting that, it's like a flag. The knowledge of the Vedas is precise. It's not guesswork. It's not perhaps maybe. It's not that there's some statement and then it's revised and then it's revised and then it's revised and then it's revised. It's definitive. 8,400,000, not more and not less. It's scientific. Prabhupada would emphasize like this. Statements from the Vedas. I'll want to go a little bit like in a footnote of that one. During the time of, I believe it was in the early or the mid 1800s, in Europe, there was an interest in European scholars towards the knowledge found in Vedic literature. Particularly Germans were interested, and then in time, English and Dutch scholars became interested in studying Sanskrit and learning the Vedas, and there was like a wave, a pendulum effect of scholarship taking interest in Vedic wisdom. And that quite alarmed some of the Christian scholars who thought, uh-oh, there's some competition on the horizon. And so systematically, they made strong propaganda that this ancient Vedic wisdom is just mythology. It's not something that a serious scholar, particularly a Christian scholar, will take serious because there's some serious competition here. And so Sataputta chronicles this in his writings. BBT is going to go forward with that publication of his articles? Sataputta is going to do it. Okay, good. But that's going to be published. So there's this history of bold statements being made by those, they're not trying to create an us and them situation or commentary. I'm just explaining some of the historical events that took place. The Christian scholars spoke that to prove that the Vedas are not to be taken seriously, those portions of the Vedic literature that deal with things that can be measured by empiric science, you can study and with your senses discern and conclude, they will prove that this is all a bunch of bunk and dismiss it. And the two areas that they said would prove was it was just at that time that Darwinian evolutionary theory, and as we know, Darwin said, in course of time, archaeology will find that according to the bones and the artifacts of archaeology, that Darwin's theory is true, that this theory is true. And so those who really pushed it said like that, this, the empiric evidence of these two areas, anthropology and astronomy, because in Vedas it gives some idea of creationism, and the disproof of creationism or the empiric science version of creationism is different, modern science version, and also the picture of cosmology. So it's natural that those who are involved in BI work would focus on these two areas, because the European scholars said long ago, these are the two areas. And then they systematically went through the selecting of archaeological evidence that would prove evolutionary theory. So very serious studies of looking, did they do an honest job to look at the archaeological records? Very important work that Jhutakarma and Sariputta have done in that field, and Vedic cosmology and cosmography also. So it's for that reason, along that line, that Prabhupada liked to take note of, like this, Markandeya Purana. It describes, in very ancient times, the details of the living entity within. They had no instruments to evaluate the living entity within the womb. There was no technology. There was no empiric verification. But now that there is empiric verification, just look. It matches. Or a stronger way of saying it is, finally they got something together in science that actually matches with what's reality. After guesswork and modification and changes, they finally came to the Vedic picture. Anyway, Hare Krishna. So I'm going to read a few verses and a little bit of the purport from Chaitanya Charitamrita, where this, just as the verse we're reading in the Bhagavatam, the mother's womb is supplying ingredients to the body of the living entity through the umbilical cord, and the ingredients, the foods that she eats, is determining what nourishment goes to the living entity that's within her womb. So, same with the each of the universes. The universes are expanding because there's a form of Garbhadakshay Vishnu within the universe, just like the body is expanding because the soul is there. The universes are expanding because, not because of the Big Bang, but because Garbhadakshay Vishnu is there. And the universes are expanding by his energizing the otherwise inanimate matter. And the space in which the planets and the universe exists, that's also, that chamber is another feature of Maya that's being supplied by the remote cause of the personality of Godhead. So it's happening on the macro, it's happening on the micro. And one who takes the benefit of faithfully hearing from the scripture can understand how the whole thing works. And to the extent that material science can research these things, bahunam janmanam ante gyanavam mam prapadyate vasudev sarvamiti. The living entities are in me and are mine. They're in Krishna's energy, which is an expansion of Krishna, and they belong to Krishna. He's the rule maker, and if he wants, he's the rule breaker. And so material energy is doing different things, but Krishna is in charge of that material energy. Mayadhyakshena prakriti. Suyate sachara, both moving and non-moving living beings. Hetunane konteya jagat viparivartate. So I'm going to read from Chaitanya Charitamrita, Adi Lila, chapter 6. This is verses 14 through 15. Translation. Just as the external energy consists of two parts, the efficient cause, nimitta, and the material cause, upadan, maya being the efficient cause and pradan being the material cause, so Lord Vishnu, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, assumes two forms to create the material world with the efficient and material causes. I don't know if that stuck, but Krishna's the remote cause, and he, by his energy, he brings maya of these two divisions, and he's directing and energizing the whole thing. Purport. There are two kinds of research to find out the original cause of creation. One conclusion is that the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the all-blissful, eternal, knowing form, is indirectly the cause of this cosmic manifestation and directly the cause of the spiritual world, where there are innumerable spiritual planets, etc. Factually, the Supreme Absolute Spirit Soul is the cause of every kind of manifestation. And he is always complete, both as the energy and the energetic. I'm going to go forward, and this is a long purport. A very long purport. Maya has two varieties of existence. One is called pradan, or prakriti. It supplies the ingredients of the material world. Because prakriti, this is still verse, translation, because prakriti is dull and inert, it cannot actually be the cause of the material world. But Lord Krishna shows his mercy by infusing his energy into the dull, inert material nature. Thus, prakriti, by the energy of Lord Krishna, becomes the secondary cause, like the mother becomes the secondary cause of producing the child. Without the seed, wombs of mothers don't produce children. And then the ultimate cause is Krishna. Without Krishna, there's no male or female features of material creation. Thus, prakriti, by the energy of Lord Krishna, becomes the secondary cause, just as iron becomes red hot by the energy of fire. Therefore, Lord Krishna is the original cause of the cosmic manifestation. Prakriti is like the nipples on the neck of a goat, for they cannot give any milk. The maya aspect of material nature is the immediate cause of the cosmic manifestation, just like the womb of the mother is the cause of the body of the child. But the whole thing doesn't work without remote cause. Even the principle of material creation is there. If Krishna doesn't sanction, it doesn't happen. If Krishna doesn't sanction, he sets the system up and he sanctions the system without his doing both. Upadrashta anumantacha. He oversees and he permits. These are his functions in relation to material creation. He sets the whole thing up, he oversees it, and it's yes or no. So this is all sambandha gyan. And what's the purpose of going through this whole exercise? When we understand what is the relationship of all things to Krishna, there's only one thing to do. You serve him. And not just with obedience or even with fear. If I don't, I'm going to get smacked. You'll burn in hell if you're not good. But it's just the reality of the situation. He's in charge. We're his part and parcel. Everything is under his supervision. Let's serve him. And let's serve him with great celebration and joy. With full understanding of what's going on here. And how marvelous he is in keeping the whole thing, the whole show going on remote control. He doesn't even have to go in and fix things. It's just indirectly. And directly. I was discussing this with Brigopati. See here? Last night. The directly and indirectly phrase that's in the Bhagavatam. He's controlling directly because it's all under his control, but he's doing it indirectly through the agency of his various energies. He's conscious directly because he's the omniscient Supreme Lord. But he's also taking care of so many things, knowing through indirect methods. And I think one last thing, because I mentioned to Brigopati, I would bring it up. What's the role of the living entity in all of this? In one sense, the role of the living entity, we're just helpless. We made a bad choice. I want to enjoy independently from Krishna, and we got sucked into this material energy. We thought it was going to be a nice program, and it turned out to be a nightmare. And then we're just going along for the ride, thinking, now I'm going to enjoy, and I'm going to counteract the suffering. But actually, it's just the material. But there are five factors to action, according to Bhagavad Gita. The living entity doesn't choose. I think I'll take the womb of this mother, and I think I'll have this gender, and I think I have this color skin, and I'll have these bodily features, and I'll have these abilities, and that's my inventory list. It doesn't work like that. But we do make choices once we're in this human form of life. We have a little rope. It's like a cow on a rope. And depending, sometimes the cows are given a long rope and sometimes a short rope. Living entity sometimes has a greater amount of freedom. And those that are more in the mode of ignorance, they're more restricted. And so the range of freedom is limited because we're limited. And the more one acts in harmony with the Supreme, we're given more freedom. And even when there's no rope, we're still under the control of Krishna. In other words, in the spiritual world, we're controlled. We're controlled voluntarily, and therefore if Krishna says, come here, we're there. Krishna says, don't go there, we don't go there. So we don't need a rope. But we're under the invisible rope, or the rope of love. And those that don't have that condition of love, they're under the rope. We're controlled. But we have some part to play, even in the conditioned stage. We have some choices to make. The consequence of the living entity in the womb of the mother, there's a helpless state because of previous choices. There are certain mothers that don't know the Vedas and they eat different things, the living entity gets burned. And some living entities, their mothers know, and so they're careful, and the living entity doesn't. So there's consequences of our past choices. But then once birth takes place, we're making choices. We're on a conveyor belt. Yes, there's the fruit of our past karma and the associations with the modes of nature that we've chosen. But then we can choose other, with that limited rope, we can choose other associations. So we can modify the experience in this life and certainly beyond this life. So there is There are five factors of action. The living entity making some endeavor is one of those factors. This condition within the womb, it's helpless. The choices have been made, and during that period of time, no choices. You can't bang on the mother's abdomen and say, you know, hey, quit eating those things. Really, it's burning my body. So the followers of the Vedic system are given this understanding, even without a pediatrician. Just follow the Vedic system. Okay, I'm going to allow some time for some discussion. Archita?
You mentioned about the European scholars attacking in a two-pronged way the Vedic knowledge.
Yeah.
And they did obviously a very good job, because even sometimes after taking to Krishna consciousness, to the Vedic path, people get blown away by some of the statements in the Vedas, and they go back to their old ways because they can't assimilate some of the cosmology in the Vedas and some of the...
Right.
So I know that you've been kind of emphasizing that in your academic preaching recently, showing Sariputta's CD and stuff like that. What kind of feedback are you getting? How have you been interacting with the academic world on these points?
I'm not sure, I'll give you an honest feedback. I'm not sure how much people are assimilating. Some people are, but I'm not sure how many. One. Otherwise, it's, wow, this is, you know, Hare Krishna guy in an orange robe is speaking about this stuff. Wow. It gives them another perspective on the Hare Krishna movement. That's one thing. And it's a brain teaser for them, because it's something they have to reach for. And they like that. They like that challenge. How much they're assimilating, I'm not sure. One of the purposes that I do this for, I feel, is being accomplished. And one of the things that I try to emphasize, I make a very strong emphasis in the very beginning. Can we make a chair for Yaso somewhere? Thank you. There's a... education is compulsory in America. And the second thing that's compulsory in America is separation of church and state. So you have to go to school and you have to learn about creation. You have to learn about how everything comes into being, and God has to be out of the picture. So atheism is mandatory. Systematic education in atheism for everybody that goes through the school system is mandatory. And you get richly, literally, rewarded for doing a nice job. So my description to them is, here's an alternative model, and it's not, not only it's not atheistic, it's very friendly, because the atheistic model is, in short, just from feedback from the audiences, is Big Bang cosmology teaches everything starts from nothing and it ends in nothing. It starts from a singularity that, with no explanation other than it just explodes. And it mass expands throughout the universe in their picture of things. And then what happens? So there's two main theories in modern science. One main theory is it just keeps expanding and expanding, and it just dissipates, because gravity no longer holds mass together, it just goes into nothingness. And there's another theory that at a certain point, gravity doesn't hold because of mass, and so it implodes back upon itself and again becomes a singularity. And Hawkins likes that one in Harvard University. So, but either way, by their statements, one graduate student association group said, they had to debate between themselves, this model, that model. And my comment was, just see, you start with nothing and you end with nothing, either model. So where does it leave us now? Those who become very expert in this picture of the expanding universe through redshift and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and understand the details of how to figure it all out mathematically and empirically. And when you step back from that picture, what is it? We're nowhere. Coming from nowhere and going nowhere, and we're nowhere. And this is another model that says it starts with God and we're with God and we go to God. And empirically, the measurements are the same. In very, very complicated, intricate ways that have no foundation in empiric evaluation of them. It's descending knowledge. So just the opposite of what, I forget, Benson, I think, was the person's name, this European scholar that was on the bandwagon to debunk Vedic scripture. So I feel it's an important message to at least put before people a cogent theistic model. Because otherwise they're in this space where they're richly rewarded and everything is atheistic, and then they have some devotional sentiments and they can't put the two things together, where the rubber hits the road, where empiric research hits Vedic statements. Take one other question because our time is up. Brigupati had his hand. Your three questions, if it's okay.
Brigupati. Arch, thank you for a very enlightening class. One thing that you said, it's sort of a follow-on from Arch's question, I'd like you to throw a little bit more light on it, is you mentioned how the Christian scholars were trying to debunk the Vedic literature, and they chose two specific areas, anthropology, specifically the work of Charles Darwin, and astronomy, and specifically focusing on creation ideas. But it seems strange to me when I heard that, because Christians don't believe in evolution, and Christians believe in creation. So they think, by showing that, using science to defeat the Vedic literature on those two points, they're also defeated. They think we were defenseless, and, we were...
Yes. That thought passed through my mind even as I was speaking. But the sleight of hand is just as the Pope, whichever Pope it was, made some papal decree that there is no, there's a marriage between creationism and modern science. Now, to me, that's a sleight of hand. And the same as what you're saying. But apparently, these scholars had some similar disposition. It was enough of a trade-off for them. I can't analyze it in detail, perhaps to your satisfaction or to mine. But there was some kind of trade-off to them that was, of the two, the swinging of intellectuals towards the Vedic scriptures was a greater threat than this idea that, Darwin imposed upon challenging the fundamental creationism concept. And therefore they chose that to devalue the Vedic literatures in this way. So I can't go further with it than that.
They took up an unholy marriage with science for the purpose of getting rid of it. They took up an unholy marriage with science.
Yes.
Temporarily,
yes.
In order to get rid of the lesser of two evils.
Yes, something like that. Thank you for picking up on that.
Comment and question.
Also,
this backfiring, everything we have done. Just now, I was coming in from Mayapur, and the airplane, they were showing a documentary about the scientists,
they were making a documentary of so many things that they cannot explain. And they were showing that actually in the past, the people was more advanced in technology. They were showing they had discovered an analog computer in the Mesopotamia that was 3,000 years old. by some kind of new systems that they have, they see that this particular metal piece actually inside has an analog computer. They also they can find out how to make steel as the way the Moroccans used to do 2,300 years ago. They cannot find the formula to make such a kind of steel. And like this, they were explaining that they cannot find out how they did it and how they were so advanced in that time. But one scientist was saying, perhaps when fire came along, then they were able to become thinkers and speeding the ability of thinking. So they're still thinking in creation and evolutionism. They don't accept yet. But still they are at least showing that they have so many things in the past that they were more advanced than today. And also they were explaining that actually they have found the remains of Troy. And Troy was supposed to be just a mythology.
Mythology, right.
Because it's in the Iliad, Homero just described such a wonderful thing. It was mythology. Now they have found out that the city actually exists.
Et cetera, et cetera.
So whatever they're trying to do, scientists now, more pure scientists in a sense, because they don't have a religious agenda, they're finding good things. They're finding it actually chronologically match with the ancient Vedas. It's very nice.
And that's your comment.
Yes, Maharaj. The question is, why we are not, as in the ISKCON movement, why we are not helping more this department, like supporting even with more input and money, so we can have programs in television and to compete with the scientists, to be able to explain what we know, like Sadaputta Prabhu was doing.
I'm not sure the whole... Are you asking... Why don't we do this more? That's essentially...
Why not to present it more scientifically through programs, scientific programs like this? Because people is eager to know.
Prabhupada wanted, and my sense is that persons with such capacity are rare. The Sadaputas of this world are rare. And just like I might guess from the BBT perspective that the market for such ideas is limited. So from our side and from that side, marketing is, you know, we can publish so many versions of Bhagavad Gita, but those more scientific literatures, there's a lesser market. And there's lesser people who are qualified to present in with such impeccable integrity that's necessary to stand up to, you know, the nitpicking, fault-finding, mentality, the puffy-wuffies of the world that will want to challenge it because it's challenging them. So you have to have very qualified people. Better to... Swabhas wants to comment.
Kinds of scientific journals. Unless you're published in a scientific journal, it's very rare to take you serious or that you'll make some mark. We see that Jhutakarma Prabhu, although he hasn't been published in a journal, because he's so outrageously, you know, critical, that he's being heard to some degree. But I've always been told that unless you, you know, come to a certain level, you're not really going to be heard or accepted or just not even listen to
people. And then there's all kinds of filters and screens before you get published in those journals.
Exactly. So it's
a well-defensed system.
Yeah, it's a really tight-knit group. And unless you're really in that group and in that particular same page, so to speak, you don't really get too much credence or credibility.
It's a power base.
Unless you make a lot of ruckus like Jhutakarma Prabhu. He's causing a lot of ruckus, so they have to kind of listen to him.
Okay. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.